You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
We welcome Open Society fellow journalist and author Basharat Peer to speak with us today about The Road from Ayodhya, Muslim Inclusion in a New India. Basharat has recently returned from India and will discuss his visit to the city of Ayodhya, site of the destruction of a historic medieval mosque by a Hindu mob and vicious anti-Muslim pogrom in 1992. Through a series of interviews he conducted in Muslim neighborhoods in New Delhi and other cities, he will also look at the ways in which India's Muslim population, the world's largest religious minority, has been trying to find its place at a time of rapid economic growth and lingering sectarian tensions. Basharat has worked as an editor at Foreign Affairs and is the author of the acclaimed memoir, Curfew Night, an unforgettable piece of literary reporting that reveals the personal stories behind the Kashmir conflict. Born and raised in the war-ravaged region of Kashmir, Basharat tells stories from his youth and gives gut-wrenching accounts of the many Kashmiris he met years later as a reporter. Pankaj Mishra writes of the book, describing the ruin of Kashmir, Curfew Night does not only shock, it challenges our most cherished beliefs in democracy, rule of law, and the power of individual conscience. Everyone should read it. Curfew Night recently won one of the top literary awards in India, the Vodafone Crossword Book Award for English Nonfiction. Basharat has also served as a correspondent at Tehelka, an English language investigative news weekly, and has contributed to The New Statesman, The Nation, The Financial Times Magazine, The Guardian, and The Times of India, amongst other publications. Basharat.
Thank you, Amrit. And thanks to OSI for the fellowship and making me able to do this, the travels in India and work on this project. So to talk about the way theme, the idea of Muslim inclusion in New India, I think I'll have to, maybe for some of us who are not very familiar with the political context, just go back to, you know, a little bit of the background, the contemporary background. Like, 90s was really, you know, a very, very turbulent decade for India in general. And two great transformations happened was post independence, like the civic religion in Indian polity was largely the idea of Nehruvian secularism, in which a government doesn't really, give preferential treatment to a particular religion, and everyone has equal rights, political, social, economic, all communities. But when we came to the point in late 80s and, you know, in almost early 90s, that was a time when the ruling party of India, which led the Indian freedom movement and later ruled India for almost 45, 50 years, the Indian National Congress, it was in decline, stagnation issues, like one party being in power for a long time, and problems of internal democracy within the party. And at that time, various political groupings were coming to the fore. A lot of it was like caste-based politics with, you know, the largely marginalized lower caste groups coming of age and like making their political parties and asserting themselves for political rights. But the more the phenomenon that really, you know, affected India and changed the shape of that whole decade and continues to affect the polity even today was the rise of Hindu nationalism, with this which was led by the political party called Bharatiya Janata Party, Indian People's Party. And for them, the rallying, I mean, they had a very minimal presence both in the Indian polity and society. But at that time, the issue around which they rallied most people was there's a small town in northern India called Ayodhya. It's around 16 hours from the capital, Delhi, and an old mosque there, like, which is a medieval mosque, the area around the mosque was considered to be the birthplace of the Hindu god Ram. And the BJP ran this campaign for building a Ram temple there instead of the mosque, and kind of to quote unquote to liberate the birthplace of the of Ram. So in December 1992, that was the time when the mobilization really centered in Ayodhya, and that the Babri Mosque, as it was called, was demolished, and that triggered a series of sectarian riots within all over India, and around 2,000 people were killed, most of whom were Muslims. I mean, these were institutionalized riots in big cities like Bombay and also other centers around North India and parts of Western India. What happened in the aftermath of that was, one was this intense fear within the largely in the Indian Muslim community, which is around 154 million. And also, it did have serious electoral gains for the BJP. And it was for the first time, there was a moment where in any civil social gathering, to speak in support of BJP was a taboo. It was almost to talk, racist talk in America. I mean, it was seen like that. But by the mid-90s, it was becoming more acceptable. And in 98, it really formed its first government. So, and BJP continued to rule India till 2004. And in that period, from 92 to 2004, what we saw was a serious failure of the state to protect minorities or to look at their various economic, social, or political rights. I mean, the worst point in that whole journey was 2002, the riots in Gujarat, where the state sided with the rioters and like around 2,000 people were killed. But the big turning point was, I was working in Delhi as a journalist at that time, was the 2004 elections, when everyone sort of assumed that BJP will come into power, because it also in early 90s, the other major transformation was that under then finance minister and now India's prime minister, Dr. Singh, I mean, there was this whole economic liberalization that was started, and the markets opened up, and I mean, despite, economic inequality, it did grow in a serious way, and jobs were coming into being. And by the time BJP came into power, that whole process had kicked in. So they went to polls with this, with two major planks. One was this very aggressive nationalism and anti-Muslim propaganda, and also the slogan that India was shining, irrespective of what was happening in the villages. I mean, the talk was all about cell phones and IT companies and the growing relationship with United States. But 2004 was a point at which, the largely silent majority sort of could no more take it, and they were voted out of power. And in the years to come, I mean, that's really when we talk about the question of Muslim inclusion in a new India. In that time, from 1992 to 2004, there was barely, in my travels and my interviews recently with various sort of activists and political leaders in India, I mean, it was very clear that nobody was talking about the idea of getting a share in the pie. I mean, it was largely dominated by fear, and Muslims seemed happy as long as there was not a riot happening or they were not being arrested or something was going on with the police. And with that break in 2004, and I remember being there in Delhi at that time, you could see this visible difference, that something was changed. It was sort of post-Bush America kind of a moment for India. And suddenly even as a journalist, you could ask a police officer three more questions, which you would hesitate, because there was this whole culture of fear that had been created. I mean, we on a routine basis, we reported on encounter killings, which was every other month, police would make an announcement that we have captured a Pakistani terrorist, and who would end up to be some small-time pickpocket from a village in Uttar Pradesh or from some other Indian state. So that had become a pattern of impunity had been established at that time. And specifically at, just before BJP lost power. And also another American connection was in the post 9/11 sort of world, there was a lot of borrowing of the rhetoric that was used in America and applied it to cases which were very different in an Indian context. Like there was this one sort of Islamist student group in India called Students Islamic Movement of India. And suddenly after 9/11, they were banned and like hundreds of members were arrested and charged, you know, charges of having linkages from Hamas to Al-Qaeda were put against them. And in my interview, so this was largely the sort of context which after which we come to this point in 2004 when BJP loses power and there's a sense of relief across India and a new government sets in. So one of the earlier decisions that the new Congress government took was this was to establish a prime ministerial committee to look at the socioeconomic indicators and the general state of Muslim minority in India. It was a committee headed by a judge called Justice Rajendra Sachar, a well-known civil liberties activist who had been working in India all his life. And when the report came out in 2006, it was a rare instance of a government actually having to, in India, to commission a report to look at the state of the nation, the state of the minorities in the nation. And at that point, the report came out and it was pretty devastating and created a lot of furor in India. So essentially, in this 400-page report, what Justice Sachar laid out was whether it came to education or representation in governments or the question of getting bank loans or even ordering a pizza from a Pizza Hut. Basically, the percentage of Muslim representation in every sector of Indian polity and economy was as bad as the lowest caste, and or actually even worse than that in many sectors. And it made a set of recommendations like, you know, providing better bank loans or creating a financial corporation which can, you know, support various minority, you know, business enterprises. But the implementation has been rather slow because to get any report implemented in Indian polity, because, you know, it's a multi-party democracy and the report has to be approved in the parliament, a lot of time just, you know, it is you just witness these endless arguments in the parliament and one session gets over and the next begins and the implementation just gets delayed. So it only became possible to have this conversation in this sort of post-BJP world. And this another report which I think will have greater ramifications on the Indian polity and the state of Indian Muslims was this other report that was appointed by the Prime Minister called Justice Ranganath Mishra Commission report, which was to recommend measures for affirmative action. And on the basis of all the data about the absence of Muslims in various sectors in Indian polity, the Mishra Commission report, which was tabled while I was in India in December, it basically recommended like 10% reservation in universities and in various in government jobs for Muslims there's a phrase that we use in India called the creamy layer, which is kind of considered the middle class. It's basically people whose income is about $900 a year. For Muslims whose income is less than $900 a year in India, the Ranganath Mishra Commission recommended that 10% of reservation in government sectors and in education. But the report is still pending in the Indian Parliament, and it created a big furor with the BJP now in opposition, making its old argument that they are appeasing the minorities and neglecting the majority. But one interesting development has been Indian state of West Bengal, which had been ruled by the left parties for the last 30 years under the, which one assumes was a secular government. The Sachar report had shown that it has 25% Muslim population, and Sachar report had shown that actually the condition of socioeconomic condition of Muslims in West Bengal was worse than that in Gujarat, where the worst riots happened. And now, also taking into consideration that there's elections coming up in West Bengal very soon, just last week, the government of West Bengal has adopted the Ranganath Mishra Commission report and basically said that it will give the 10% reservation to Muslims in education and jobs. So that is that's sort of the policy side of what is going on there regarding this question. But there's other issues we can talk about. But I was also interested in looking at, these are government committees. These are both committees which are established by the Prime Minister of India. But I was interested in, whenever we talk about India, there's this talk about this vigorous democracy and like serious electoral participation and a lot of noise with all kinds of organizations being in play. So I was interested in looking at the question of Muslim activism or Muslim politics. One of the big groups, or like the foremost Muslim group there, has been this group which came into being after the demolition of the Babri Mosque, and it's called Babri Masjid Action Committee. So this winter, there was another report. India, it's a country of reports. We have a report every other day. And so there was this another report which came after 17 years on how the Babri Mosque was demolished. It's called the Liverhan Report. It said everything that, you know, every high school student in India knew. Nothing, I mean, there was nothing in the report. It just took 17 years to say nothing. So the Babri Masjid Action Committee it's headquartered in Lucknow, which is in the capital of the biggest Indian state of Uttar Pradesh. So I traveled to Lucknow to sit through some of their sessions to get a sense of, you know, how organized or how effective sort of Muslim activism or politics in India is. And the meeting was local college, and in the basement of which was a computer lab. There were around a room as big as this, and there were around 20 people sitting there with all these desktop terminals along the walls. And you walk in, and you know you're walking into a computer lab. And then that was the talk. Then everyone discussed the Liberhan report and said, we know exactly what it says, and there's nothing new. But we are glad that it doesn't really make any adverse remarks on us. And in 15 minutes, you know, the whole question of the debate on Babri Masjid was over. But what I saw them most charged about was talking about the Ranganath Mishra report, about reservations and about the question of affirmative action. And I asked, like, what were the modes they were using to lobby? Because their reaction, it wasn't that in the first place that because of their lobbying that the report was tabled in the parliament. It was just out of the goodwill of, you know, the certain people in the government that the report was like commissioned in the first place. And they said that now we have to lobby for the implementation of the report. So there's a whole tradition of marching on the Indian parliament, where anyone who has a grievance takes like a few hundred thousand people, if you can manage those numbers, which is very easy in India. And then you have a day-long protest outside the Indian parliament, and nobody talks to you, police blocks all the roads, but all the press comes and you can basically say what you want to say. I mean, it is called the protest street, really. And that was the talk for like half an hour. They were debating when we should do this. And then somebody said that, you know, it would cost us at least 3 to 4 lakh rupees, which is around $8,000 at max. And suddenly the meeting was quiet, and they were like, but that's a lot of money. And then we have to put up all these people in Delhi. We can't afford to do this. And this was the foremost like political group talking about Muslim politics in India. And that was, which was quite shocking to me. But then it also made sense in the context of larger socioeconomic conditions. And then the decision that was made was not very far from Lucknow. There's a place called Amethi, which has been represented throughout the years by the Nehru-Gandhi family. But Indira Gandhi used to fight from there, Sonia Gandhi and like Rahul, they're all from there, like the premier Indian political family contest elections from there. Then the decision was made that, okay, we'll hold a rally at Amethi, and anything that's said there will hopefully reach the center of power in Delhi. But that was one sign, was there was a sort of desperation that somehow we need to get something, but without any, one of the members in that meeting was a MP, a member of the Indian Parliament, who said, you know, when the debate over this report was going on, he tried to like speak in the House, but because he came from a party that didn't really have any numbers, he didn't even get his turn to talk about it. So in terms of, you know, serious political activism or lobbying on this question, it was really sad. I mean, there was nothing much happening there. And it's a similar state in terms, I looked at a couple of community newspapers that were being published out of Delhi. And when I was interviewing the editor, who said that this is like the biggest English language newspaper focusing on Indian Muslim issues, I asked him about the circulation. He said, you know, when it will be worth talking about, I'll tell you. And then I kept interviewing. So this was this in not very far from the Indian Parliament, like in 40-minute drive, there's this ghetto in South Delhi, which has around 500,000 people living there. And it's like, you know, you go to Baltimore or you go to any other urban ghetto in America. But the difference is the infrastructure is equally grim, but there's no street crime somehow. I mean, there's no, so that's the difference. But it looks the same in terms of the infrastructure. And talking to even like a lot of young people there, what was very clear was that, you know, the various denominational Muslim political organizations really don't have any, you know, political muscle or real influence in terms of policy making. And it seemed that, you know, a lot of the young people, then I was interviewing a lot of young, middle-class, educated Muslims, and they were distancing themselves from these groups like Babri Masjid Action Committee or a local community paper. I mean, these are people who are way internet savvy and, like, you know, said we go to BBC for the news or we have this blog or things like that. But the big question there while I was talking to them was this, what I found was that there is this whole new middle class that's coming into being. It's small, but there's a certain aspirational class. And a lot of these young educated people had jobs as doctors or techies. And one person with whom I spent a lot of time, he came from a very poor district in Uttar Pradesh, and after various degrees in marketing and IT, is now working in the India back office for Morgan Stanley and actually making a lot of money. But when I went to see where he lives, so it was, he did live in the ghetto, and that sort of led me to think about the housing issues, and that is a serious challenge for the sort of the middle class that's in the making. And he was, you know, I could afford to go and live in any other middle class area, but I can't, because if you have a Muslim name, you can't rent a place elsewhere. So those were some of the like major issues in terms of, you know, the challenges they're facing there. But I tried to ask people whether there are areas where you can actually rent places or buy places. So there's some places where you can buy, but the question of like renting an apartment, that was sort of universal throughout the metros. That was the sense I got. So a lot of these younger people are more like, you know, we are here and there's no way of getting out or talking about immigration to Canada or like wherever you can go. Because despite, you know, vertical professional mobility, you're kind of limited to a particular social space. So, yeah, it's there.
Yeah, I just quickly ask a follow-up question that relates to something you just said. I'm sure I'd like you to continue along the thoughts that you've already put there. You said You said that the educated Muslims were distancing themselves from the Babri Masjid Action Committee. And why was that?
I mean, they just thought they were largely ineffective, mm-hmm. and that there's this dominant feeling that, you know, that kind of politics hasn't gotten us anything, and that what was very interesting was this big talk about we need to get, you know, better education, better places in universities, and, you know, you have to move on your own. I mean, it's sort of this fracturing. There's this big talk about the community should get like reservations, but you talking to individuals, there's this like really intense feeling of the only way to get ahead is like get better education and get into like the job market. And a lot of people, because the education levels within Muslims were very low, a lot of people explained that in the sort of pre-92 sort of in the sort of socialist India, even when Congress was ruling, there was and that's something the Sacha report says, that there was serious, you know, job, because the job market was largely public sector, and there was serious discrimination when it came to hiring Muslims in the government services or in banks or anywhere else. So a lot of them said that partly because we never got jobs, we didn't really bother. This is the older generation. We didn't bother to, you know, think much about getting bigger degrees. And that had been a dominant phase for a very long time. But with the sort of opening up of the markets and like a lot of new jobs being created, I was sort of initially when I went there, because the only people who actually talk about the minority question is the left of center intelligentsia or activists in India generally. So I kind of, when I went there, it was the question of economic reforms and opening up of the markets is a question, a big debate in India. So I was sort of assuming that they would align themselves more with the left of center politics in India. But it was a total surprise. Every Muslim neighborhood I went to do interviews, they were the biggest supporters of economic reforms. They're like, you know, a company might make me work 4 hours more and not give me enough leave, but the big corporations don't really care whether, you know, I am Muslim or not. So that was one new thing for me. This overwhelming support for this new market economy and thinking that, you know, this is where we have a chance.
So I don't know how you want to do this, Prasad. Do you want to talk some more and then throw it open for questions, or would you like people to start asking questions now?
I could. There's a if people want to ask questions, I could do that, or I could go on talking. Sure.
Go ahead. Hold on a second.
Oh, sorry. Okay. You said you... Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Susan Tucker with the Criminal Justice Fund at OSI. You said you were surprised to find that the Muslims did support economic reform?
Yes.
Why were you surprised?
Because largely, you know, I mean, what happens in India is this is sort of the local context of the political. A lot of people who would actually, you know, throughout this whole BJP period, there has been like a serious reversal on civil liberties. So most people who would actually write or raise the question of civil liberties, or, you know, random arrests, or, you know, the failure of the government to come up with evidence before arresting people, especially Muslims, they were mostly, you know, leftist activists and writers. So those were the people who were actually the only people who were really engaged with the sort of minorities in India. So that was, I mean, if you would go to any place in India with a Muslim population, the people really engaging there, or like, you know, talking about the condition there, were mostly people like, you know, left activists. And I thought they would have a serious influence there. But while, you know, that relationship continues, you know, throughout my interviews, that's what it seemed. They were like, you know, yes, these people are very nice, and they, I mean, nobody talks about us, but they're the only people who actually raise this question. but just, you know, the protest politics or raising the question of why there was an unlawful arrest, it doesn't change the basic, you know, situation, which is one of economic deprivation. And that's what you heard a lot.
So the left is for or against the economic reform?
Left is critical of the economic reforms. And I mean, and there are valid criticisms. But there's huge inequality. There are areas in which things are not working, or the income gap in India is widening at an alarming pace. But in these areas where I was, and these are some of the most neglected parts of India, I was quite surprised, because I thought this is what the politics would be. It's my own assumptions. But going there, it made perfect sense, because if there's a system that's creating possibilities for a lot of people on the margins to get more jobs, and there was this in the rural areas, there was this one new scheme that has been started by the Indian government. It's called National Rural Employment Guarantee Act, which is sort of the biggest experiment in Keynesian economics, wherein they're ensuring that the poorest of the poor get work is created so that, like, they can at least work as laborers for 148 days a year. And it's the funding goes in billions, and that's having an impact in the villages, and the larger, you know, sort of this whole middle class, or like the small middle class, whatever it is, the fact that this is for the first time becoming possible, even when they live in these, like, extremely, you know, depressing conditions in these ghettos in the cities, what you did see there was there were people driving cars, which it takes a lifetime for a person who has lived in India to buy. And they were actually making some money, but the politics of identity was confining them to a particular space. It was very grim living there, but one of the things, I was talking to a property dealer there, a broker, and he said, you know, we don't live here because we are poor. And then he was telling me about what a two-bedroom or a three-bedroom apartment goes for in that particular area, and it was the same price that any upper middle class neighborhood in Delhi an apartment would cost. It was a lot of money. I mean, it was 50 lakh rupees, which, you know, I mean, I it's it takes you a lifetime to make that. Yeah.
Just a couple of things. Basharath, you point out the BJP lost power,
right,
in 04. But the reality is that they're still in power in a lot of states,
right,
at least in coalition or sometimes alone, whatever, 30-40%
right,
of states. So to what extent are BJP nationalist, sometimes reactionary politics still played out in major states in India? To what extent has the emigre Indian community that helped bankroll them,
okay,
obviously not to success in parliamentary national elections, but in state elections,
right,
continuing to do so, detrimentally? The second is, you didn't speak it too much on Ayodhya, but I'm just wondering,
sure,
is the public consciousness right now, or public perception outside of the nationalist community, that there never was a Hindu temple there, never existed?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a recognition now in sort of popular perception that it was a myth or not? And secondarily, has there been any attempt by the government to discuss rebuilding the Babri Mosque, or was that never an issue on the table? And then just with Susan next to me, you and I had discussed the prison population in India for Muslims of some 40% to 50%. Is that also
1% of the population, are they?
14.
So it's very similar to here.
Yeah. Now I'll come to those. I mean, it's just like, it's hard to talk nonstop. No, that's fine. So the question of the idea that there was not a Hindu temple there, I mean, it's really a question of belief. It's a question of religious belief. But when I traveled there just this winter, I mean, on an earlier visit there in 2003, when, you know, BJP was at the prime of its power, this was soon after the Gujarat riots, the man who was heading this movement for the Ram Temple in Ayodhya was a man called Paramhans. He was a sadhu from a militant sect, and he had been fighting this he was the man, really, it was his idea. He pushed it since 1949. And so he was, at that time, he was negotiating with the then Prime Minister of India and saying that, I want to start the foundation stone laying rituals. And there was like the highest level bureaucrats coming and going between Delhi and Ayodhya and trying to persuade them not to. And there was a Supreme Court ban on any construction on that site. And they were trying to defy that. Now that was a very different atmosphere. There were like thousands of people there with thousands of police and paramilitary people. But this time when and this place where he was holding all of his press conferences, there was, it's also a big workshop where hundreds of workers were actually building the blocks that were supposed to come together to make the temple. So there was this like pink limestone blocks there, and they were carving like, you know, figurines and figures of gods and floral designs, and hundreds of people at work. And they would say, we need 24 hours and 8 machines to put together the temple. So got to this recent visit, when I went there, I mean, Paramhans is dead. I mean, he died a few years back. But I went to the site of this workshop, and I mean, there was nobody there. It was just quiet, and all those blocks were still there, but mostly covered with moss. And the supervisor who was in charge of the workshop, I talked to him. I said, what is happening to the temple movement? He said, you know, BJP was in power for 8 years, and they couldn't do anything. Now it's all over. So in some ways, I think, you know, those who believe that particular piece of land was the birthplace of Ram would continue to believe that. It's a question of belief. But there's no active moment within the larger, you know, country beyond Ayodhya where people are actively working towards starting a new movement for the construction of this temple. I mean, it's sort of an old slogan that is really diffused by now. And on the question of, like, you know, the BJP losing power but still being in the states, I mean, we still have Gujarat, which is where Narendra Modi is still the prime minister, and he was, despite his involvement in the sort of pogroms of 2002, he was elected 3 times. And he has very strong support within the Indian American, within a large section of the Indian American community, and that's where the funding comes from. I mean, although sort of, I think the India itself has moved on a lot and is at a better place where the new god is money and there's ambition of different sort, but some recent interactions with the sort of Indian American supporters of the BJP gave me a sense that they're still stuck in the 90s, and not much has changed there.
I'm Maya Daruwala. I work in India. I'm the director of the Commonwealth Human Rights Initiative. I wondered, when you went over there,
right,
did you meet with the Milli Council people as well as with the Jamaat people and the Deoband people? Because they all represent 5-6 different kinds of color.
Right.
The BMAC is, as you say, a spent force, and they have not been careful to nurture or to move on, just like the spent force of the BJP, VHP type,
right,
and the Ayodhya movement. But having said that, I also want to say that I think that the seeds of the kind of dissension and advocacy that was done at the time when Advani led that march still remain and very much alive.
Sure.
And I worry about that, about the conditions being ripe again, let's say if Modi makes a contested bid for Prime Minister. I think it would be too easy to raise those same hate specters.
No, that's true.
And but the other questions, I had a lot of questions on what do you think that one should do to assist the Muslim community to advocate better, both as a sectarian group, but as well as a progressive group, because this thing about criminal justice, we've also done a little bit of studying on it, and we find that in Gujarat today, last month, two months before, that almost 80% of all the cases are of Muslims just being picked up.
Yeah, I was going to come to that. Yes, I mean, I did talk to various other groupings too, but especially with the sort of more vocal and the biggest Islamist group is Jamaat Islami, which is very different from the Jamaat Islami in Pakistan or Bangladesh, because they sort of totally sort of adopted to the fact that they represent they're part of a minority community in a sort of multi-ethnic society where actually they don't have much power. I mean, there's two interesting developments that's been in terms of these other colorings that's been going on. Jamaat has come to the point earlier it started as an out and out Islamist party, but now it's more in terms of every time when there are elections, Jamaat goes on to campaign for the Congress, and I have witnessed that and sort of done a series of interviews with them. And at the moment, I mean, you know, recently when I was in Delhi, I mean, it's sort of become a fashion within various sort of Muslim factions that who will give the biggest call that terrorism is against humanity. Like, we had a whole bunch of mullahs from this seminary in Deoband and from a couple of other places riding a train to Bombay after 9/11, after the Bombay attacks, and calling it the peace train, and taking there was this whole initiative that the terrorists who attacked Bombay will not be given a place in a Muslim graveyard. So, I mean, all that is there. What is, I think partly the problem is the seminary people get a lot more print space in the media than the actual influence they have within sort of actual Muslim populations. I mean, it's only 4% of the sort of total number of Muslim students who actually in India who go to seminaries. So, which again, and that's again the poorest of the rural poor. I mean, I went to Deoband and talked to people there. I mean, it's again, the whole business is conducting within the discourse of Indian nationalism. The first thing you see when you enter the gates of the seminary is this big poster talking about their role in the Indian freedom struggle. But they have been doing this. I mean, there's this whole sort of fatwa politics wherein they have been giving fatwas against Osama bin Laden, fatwas against Lashkar-e-Toiba, against all kinds of militant violence. But how much of an impact that, I think the sort of larger Muslim society is, there's more, I mean, I was focusing on Babri Masjid because it was sort of action committee. It is a spent force, but I thought it was more representative of the regular Muslim, not just the, you know, the orange beards. I mean, and on the question of prisons, yes, I interviewed various people, and what is interesting in terms of these Gujarat, obviously, and with this banning of Simi in 2004, there were hundreds of cases where, you know, people were just taken away from homes and arrested throughout India. And the evidence, I mean, even the charges haven't been framed properly. When you look at those first FIR reports, but that's true of, like, you know, almost every criminal case that's being fought in a court of law. And it's the subsect of the general. It's not particularly sort of a Muslim problem, but it does get many, many times worse when it comes to their interactions with the court of law. I mean, there are times when there was this person whom I interviewed called Yasin Patel. He was the head of this student group a long time ago. And then in 2000, he's from Gujarat, and after the riots in Gujarat, he moved to Delhi because he felt very insecure in May. And soon after he moved to Delhi, he was arrested and booked under what is the Indian equivalent of the Patriot Act called Prevention of Terrorism Act. And the evidence against him was that he was pasting on a wall outside a university in Delhi an anti-India poster. And the poster was a 90, and he says that, you know, he actually was not doing that. He was just taken from his house. And the poster was actually, there was a fist, and it was a critique of the UN. It said US, France, the veto powers, and said, why is UN being a handmaiden of these powers? And and he was in prison for more than 4 years, and much later, because when the cases just take so long to get to the point where a judge would actually look at the evidence. So you are arrested, and the trial will happen 3 years from now. And after the trial takes place, he was acquitted, but you can't make up for those 3 years. And that is the norm in 90% of the cases that go through the Indian legal system. There's a man I interviewed who was like arrested for bicycle theft, another person for traveling without ticket. He had been in prison for 4 years, an offense for which you can be only charged for like a month. So among this 40% of this population, of this sort of Muslim population in the Indian prisons, most of them, a heavy majority of them, is like very small, petty offense for which they could actually get bail if they had legal help, or you know, they just got arrested and then somebody forgot to take them to the court. So people just end up being in the prison.
I'll just make this very quick. Kind of following off of, this is Bipasha, by the way. I'm with the fellowship program. Just kind of following off of one of Maya's points, seems like there's grave apathy in India on issues of political justice or political liberties, whether it's housing reform, whether it's among, especially among the Muslim community, the point that you make that people just aren't responding, that magazines that talk about political issues just don't have subscription rates and so on. What do you see as a big gap, whether it's education of youth, whether it's civic participation, whether it's media, in terms of getting people to mobilize around issues? I mean, do you see a big outstanding gap, particularly in ways in which Muslim communities do and do not respond to a quest for mobilization? I mean, if their focus right now is being a part of this economic growth, is there a way to also pick out a portion of that and use channel energies towards pushing for reform on the streets? Do you see any chances there, any big gaps?
I mean, there are times when some issue would really mobilize the whole country, and like, you know, after Gujarat, I mean, there was like intense mobilization of the civil society. But I think, I mean, the problem in India is like, even before you're able to process one tragedy, another is upon you, and it just goes on. I mean, and housing rights is not even a question of debate. Just because the scale of reality you're dealing with is so immense that, you know, people are like, you know, at least you have a house. I mean, that too is a question. And even, I mean, it was, even when I was talking to these people, this was only like the way the educated, middle class, you know, professionals who were thinking in those terms. But a lot of people just seem thankful for the fact that there's at least a house in whatever kind of a place to be in. I mean, I think more can be done on that, but there's nothing very organized. It just happens. I mean, there's some question or some incident that just rallies everyone or the media. I mean, media has been, it's a big role that the media plays, especially with the television channels. The magazines and the papers, I mean, you know, there are some very good magazines which do very decent work on these questions, but who reads them? That's the problem. I mean, and with television, it has been a bit of a disaster. I mean, it is the usual, it's the nature of that whole breaking news cycle. So nuance and is not always, you know, on their side. And yes, I mean, there are serious biases in terms of how TV covers these issues. So, I mean, I haven't seen a single, you know, 5-minute story on primetime Indian news ever talking about, you know, housing rights. The only time actually the housing rights were talked about was last year when a B-grade Bollywood actor was refused housing in a very elitist housing society. And he went, he called a press conference and said, they denied me housing because I'm a Muslim. And they said, no, because you have a bad reputation. He said, there are people who have worse reputation than me who are in the community. So it is like, you know, extremely ridiculous, the level at which, you know, even at that one point, the debate took place. Yeah, Faisal.
Faisal Bari, OSI Pakistan, out of New York. I just want to take you back to this issue of the connection between, in a way, capitalism, globalization, that entire sort of
right.
Opening up of the society in a very particular way, and the involvement in the political process. Because I'm finding that when I look at Pakistan also, the entire youth, so the choice is between individually moving out of a certain sphere, class, school, whatever, and as opposed to taking political action, which is obviously jointly with a group and so on and so forth. If you have more opportunities for individually moving through private schooling, private colleges, et cetera, to a better income or a better country, better space, the cost for doing that seems to be much less than going through the political process and trying to change the entire process. So you find a lot of people in Pakistan, also a lot of youth in Pakistan, going through the private routes, etc., choosing not to get involved in the political process at all. And that's been a problem till the justice movement happened, which is a blip in Pakistan also, but none which involved the youth. But other than that, we've been talking about youth apathy for a long time. So what I'm thinking, so there's this larger problem, which I'm sure one would be a comment from you on, let's say, the Hindu youth. Are they involved in the political process? Though, of course, the imperatives are different, but are they involved in, is the post-2004 change in the environment anything to do with, and lack of slight decline in the maybe popularity of BJP to do with youth pulling out, becoming more apathetic, looking at the choices that they can make privately being much more profitable for them than to go through the larger political process?
That is one of the factors. I mean, it works differently for minorities and for majorities. Like, if you're part of a majority community, there are many questions that you don't even have to deal with. But in case of, like, if we take the question of the other major minority in India, the Sikhs, 1984 was like a whole pogrom of Sikhs in Delhi after Indira Gandhi's killing. Or Punjab saw militancy throughout the 80s and a lot happened there. But I mean, there's the slight difference, because largely the Sikh population of India was concentrated in one place. And they could get, you know, a significant amount of political power in the state of Punjab through electoral politics. That did help. But I think beyond that, what was the big factor, the route they chose was if you look at the business community in Delhi, like small businesses, it was, there were two routes. Like, then one was like serious immigration to Canada or to various other Western countries where people, you know, try to build new lives and move on, or to sort of aggressively join small businesses and to try to build. I mean, it's not that they have serious political clout throughout India, but yes, what makes it complicated in terms of, you know, the Indian Muslim minority is that it's a huge number. When we're talking numbers, it's very, very big, but it's also scattered throughout the length and breadth of India. So what you have in terms of political participation was this one person that, there's this town called Gorakhpur where I was interviewing this local Muslim politician, and he used a very cricketing metaphor for the state of affairs. He's, you know, the cricket team has 11 players, but there's also a 12th player always, in case somebody gets injured or, you know, can't play, then it's his turn. He said, you know, I'm the 12th man. He had been in every political party in India. He had contested like 9 elections and never won. He said, because I have 20% of the vote in my district. So you can, through political participation, maybe make a difference to the fortunes of the winning party. But if they choose, they can actually do without you. So because of the nature of how this population is dispersed, that works against it in terms of pure, you know, cynical electoral calculations. And the places where they have more numbers, where they can really affect the fortunes of a political party, there they do engage. But yes, the younger population, irrespective of what denomination they come from, is looking more at what are the possibilities and doing that. I mean, in people from my generation, only those get into politics who either have families in politics or someone, you know, who can't really do anything else. I mean, there was a great department in Delhi University which was famous for producing student politicians. It was the Department of Buddhist Studies, where nobody ever had to take a class. When I was a student there, I mean, anyone from Buddhist Studies would go into the Youth Congress. I mean, that was the norm. Right. No, I was talking more in terms of electoral politics. Well, no, there are student, you know, wings of all parties, and but still, I mean, largely as a choice, when we are talking of sort of joining that professional class, I mean, that's also actually a, you know, pragmatic professional choice for somebody without even a high school degree. Signing up with the youth wing of any political party ensures that you get a local government contract. I mean, it's a different kind of a hustle, which gives you political clout and some money.
I'm Stan Higginbotham with the Paul and Daisy Soros Fellowships for New Americans. The research you've done, I think, is really very important, in part to simply raise consciousness of the problem faced by Muslims within India. But what it can also do is change and refine our understanding of conventional wisdoms. And I'd like to present three conventional wisdoms, and perhaps you could tell us how you have improved that. One conventional wisdom was that Congress, when it was in power, simply, you know, paid lip service to integrating Muslims, but largely tried to hide the extent of violence against Muslims and the problems of Muslims. So one question is, to what extent have things gotten worse for Muslims since Ayodhya, or to what extent is just we're more aware of it?
Shall I answer that first?
If you want, sure.
I think, you know, Congress, in its own journey, when with Nehru becoming the first prime minister, there was an idealism, and you know the whole idea of there's a whole phrase which came into being called Nehruvian secularism, and that was really the civic religion of India for a long time. But later, with his daughter coming to power, Indira Gandhi, she was the one who used this whole calculation of religion in a rather cynical way, and she was, you know, Muslims are only 14%. It was mathematics. Mm-hmm. And she did various things and said various things which ensured that Muslims were pushed to the sidelines and that she had a grip on the majority of the population, on the vote. And later under Rajiv Gandhi, I mean, there were some miscalculations, but I think there really has been a serious major transformation of the Indian society and polity in the last 20 years. It is a very different world now. I mean, sort of, because it was a one-party kind of a state with serious Russian influences. I mean, there was a lot of KGB kind of thinking, and that still, you know, remains there in the bureaucracy and police to some extent. But I think it's changed a lot, and you know, and now with sort of, I mean, 80s was a very bloody, very dangerous decade for India, with all minorities coming under serious attacks, like the massacres of Sikhs or the riots in India against Muslims. There were like, you know, there's scores of names of, you know, you can just take the names of places and everyone recognizes what happened there. So yes, I mean, 90s saw the rise of BJP and there were serious problems, but at this current moment, I think there's we are moving towards some degree of optimism. I mean, I really think there's optimism at this moment, though where we have to start is actually quite a grim borderline.
I guess the second conventional wisdom is that there's tremendous variation across the states in the situation of Muslims in the South.
Right.
You know, the conventional wisdom is they're not as badly discriminated against, and their variations east and west, and certainly in Kashmir. Did you get a sense? I didn't get a sense of how widely your interviews were conducted, and whether you got a feeling for differences.
On this trip, as part of the OSI research, I haven't yet gone to the South, but this is from my earlier interviews. Yes, the South is very different from the North, because what also affects politics in North was the legacy of the partition, the creation of Pakistan. And it was like an extremely violent event whose legacy lives on in North India in a more intense way. The South wasn't really affected by the history, by partition. I mean, it's like going to another country. I mean, I don't even understand the language. I have to communicate in English when I travel there. And another factor that made a big difference in the South was there was immense outward migration of both Muslims and Hindus and Christians to the Gulf states, where they all worked as, you know, laborers, professionals, which brought in a large degree of prosperity and created this the educational status is much better there for everyone. So yes, the South is definitely better off. Assam, parts of Northeast have problems, and then Bengal, as I said, there were no riots because it was a left-led government, but the socioeconomic indicators were bad, and I mean, they were bad for everyone, and just worse for Muslims.
Why don't you go ahead?
I'm Steve Hubble from the Open Society Fellowship Program. My question is, has economic liberalization, globalization, as well as the economic downturn globally, produced among Hindu nationalists a bit of a populist backlash? In other words, a sense that ancient distinctions which operated to their benefit were being obliterated, and that their own status, the status of Hindu conservatives was at risk.
No, actually, I mean, the whole process of globalization or economic liberalization has worked in very strange ways. One is this sort of overwhelming desire I found among the Muslims or even Dalits, where I was writing about before I came to OSI, there is this overwhelming desire among the minorities to join the middle class. But what happened with sort of the Hindu right, which was in the middle class, and actually the significant, you know, support base of the Hindu right was the middle class, the upwardly mobile classes. And with that money also came this very aggressive militant nationalism, of which we saw throughout the 90s. So there is these people on the margins who desire and, you know, are hoping for a share of the pie. But there was also a significant part of the Hindu right is actually very upwardly mobile, urban, middle class, and it works in different ways with who you are. I mean, really, I cannot say that this change in the nature of political economy in India has worked in only one way. It's far too, it's a continent you are dealing with.
Naseem from CEP. My question pertains to the structure of the population. How much is the percentage of the, the established class in the upper strata where they can bring any change via integrating into the, or trying, or can help to integrate the leftovers into the power structure.
Of, do you mean the percentage of Muslims and the
the Muslim ones? Yeah.
There is a small elite. I mean, that again goes back. There's a whole history to it. When the partition happened, most of the Indian Muslim elite moved to Pakistan, and we always used to read it in textbooks or like hear about it in India in any political form. But when I first traveled to Pakistan, I mean, that's when I realized it was true. I mean, like Karachi elite is basically, it's the former, you know, North Indian Muslim elite. So yes, there are visible presences, especially in sports or in Bollywood, and there's some in the media. But it's still, you know, proportionately a smaller percentage, but it exists, and people play their role as citizens of a country. A class always works in like a class. I mean, there was this whole question of affirmative action. I interviewed some people who are from like some of the most well-known Indian Muslim families, and they were extremely uncomfortable with it. They're like, you know, we have made it on our own. We don't need this. And then I'll have to walk around with the cross. The vice chancellor of a university told me that. So there's definitely a small elite which works with the system. I mean, that's what every minority does. And how far they are successful or influential, I don't think they can push for things too hard, because if you are part of a small elite, you tend to guard your own personal interests rather than raise difficult questions. I mean, the only place where you actually do have a huge middle class is in J&K, which is a mostly Muslim area state, but that is a very different political history. Kashmir has, I mean, that's a very different story altogether. That's where I come from, and you know, there the political economy is very different, the social structure is very different, but I mean, just looking at Indian TV is a good sample of how many people with Muslim names do you see, and it's, if you look at, you know, number of reporters on TV channels or anchors, you do find a few. It's always a small number though.
I think we have to end here. Thank you very much, Pachata.
Thanks.